Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the role of international law in keeping the world safe, clean, and tranquil? The United Nations, the Geneva Conventions, and the International Criminal Court are hailed by their champions as indicators that we are making progress toward a world of peaceful, rational interactions between states. But while my guest doesn't dispute the potential benefits of international cooperation, he believes that a clear-eyed analysis of the workings of international law reveals its power to be far more limited than many people imagine. Eric A. Posner is Kirkland and Ellis Professor of Law at the University of Chicago. He explores the issue in his new book, The Perils of Global Legalism. Eric, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
You define global legalism as excessive faith in the efficacy of international law. Can you explain that?
Sure. Well, international law is sometimes thought of to be just like domestic law. And we know that domestic law works pretty well. People obey the law most of the time. And domestic law keeps order, keeps crime at a minimum, cleans the environment, and does all kinds of good things. International law, though, is a different animal altogether. It's much weaker, and there's a basic reason for this, which is that there's no international government of any kind that's comparable to the national government, which makes and enforces domestic law. The result is that international law really is something more analogous to sort of social norms among nations, these weak rules of conduct that nations use to guide their behavior and to cooperate where they can. But it's important to keep in mind that it's very difficult for nations or even individuals to cooperate without some kind of external agent to make the rules and enforce them. And so it's dangerous to put too much faith in international law for solving the world's problems.
You drive home the point here that international law requires the consent of individual states, but those states are almost always bound to be loyal first to what they perceive as their own self-interest.
Yeah, and there's a bit of a paradox at the bottom of international law. Just as a matter of legal doctrine, a rule of international law exists only if states consent to it, as you mentioned. But what happens when a state changes its mind and doesn't want to comply with that law anymore because, it's realized its interests are different from what the law says? Well, you know, it can withdraw its consent. And it's now, many people would say, well, it's violating international law, but it's really not that clear whether it's violating international law or it's simply withdrawing its consent to the rules that had formerly bound it. And because there's no real international court that can step in and interpret the law and resolve these issues and enforce them, one's left with really, you know, not much to say. You can criticize the state, but it's unclear what you can do beyond that. Now, just to answer your question a little more precisely, it's not surprising that states agree to rules that will sometimes constrain their self-interest. So to take something like global warming, now that it appears that states have realized that, agree that global warming is a serious problem, it's in every state's interest to restrict its emissions, even though it would be even better for any particular state if everybody else restricted their emissions while that state did not do it itself. So the state has a kind of long-term interest in everybody restricting their emissions. The other guys will only agree to it if that state agrees to it as well. But as time passes, any particular state might be tempted, because of the economic cost, to start polluting more than it's supposed to be. And that's what makes the whole approach to using international law so delicate and potentially unstable.
In general, what are the perceived benefits of compliance with international law for any particular state?
Well, I guess first one has to think about the specific legal regime. So in the case of, let's suppose, a climate treaty, which is being negotiated right now, let's consider the United States. So if the United States complies with that climate treaty, then it's more likely that other countries will comply with the climate treaty as well, so that in the long run, the problem of global warming will be addressed. Now, there may be other general reasons why states comply with international law. If you, you know, make promises, if you say you're going to if you enter a treaty, for example, and then you subsequently say, well, I've changed my mind, that's going to hurt the state's reputation and make it more difficult for that state to obtain to enter into cooperative relationships with other states later on. So it can hurt your reputation in general if you frequently and flagrantly violate international law, and that's probably one of the main reasons why states, in fact, do comply with international law most of the time.
And because we don't have a sort of overarching system of international governance, the consequences for states that disobey very often have a lot to do with sort of just evaluating the relative strength of their adversaries.
Yes, and a particularly good example of this comes from international trade law. So we have this complicated system of international trade, which is governed by an international organization called the WTO, or the World Trade Organization. And so states have agreed to reduce tariffs and other trade barriers. And if then a state subsequently violates its obligation, then the other states that are victims of that violation can bring a claim before the WTO and obtain a remedy of some sort. But here's the problem. You know, normally if, you know, you and I had a breach of contract dispute in domestic courts and I sued you and won, you'd have to pay me money and the court could enforce that by literally seizing your property and having it auctioned off. But in the international level, if, let's say, a relatively small country like Mexico brings a claim against the United States and wins, it's not entitled to any money from the United States. What it's entitled to do is raise its own tariffs against the United States. Now, that's pretty much a useless remedy for Mexico, because if it raises its own tariffs, that will just raise the cost of goods that it imports from the United States, which will end up hurting Mexico much more than it hurts the United States. Hmm. By contrast, if the United States is bringing the claim against Mexico and the United States wins, its threat to raise trade barriers will hurt Mexico much more than the United States. So there's this huge asymmetry in international relations. Big states are always in a better position than little states. And international law tends to accept this, which means that even when big states violate international law in a way that hurts little states really don't have much in the way of a remedy.
So the WTO and the United Nations and all these groups, there really isn't the equivalent of sort of one state, one vote.
Well, that's another important issue. As a matter of doctrine, there's an idea known as sovereign equality in international law, which simply means that all states are equal. And what that means is that, as a matter of theory, you can't force any particular state to submit to international law unless it gives its consent. But in practice, the big states call the shots, and sometimes this is formally reflected in international institutions. Of course, the most famous example is the United Nations. In the General Assembly, every state has a seat and every state has a single vote. But the General Assembly is literally not allowed to make law. It's as though Congress were not allowed to make law, although it could have votes and, you know, they could pass resolutions just stating their political opinions on certain issues. The Security Council is the institution which can actually make law. It can issue legally binding orders. Well, in the Security Council, five states, the United States, Russia, China, France, and Britain, have what's called permanent seats, whereas other states rotate on and off the council. And these five permanent members also have vetoes. So nothing can be done without their consent. And so even in the United Nations, which is really the heart of the international system, the big states, particularly these five big states, have vastly more power than the other countries in the world.
Eric A. Posner is my guest. His new book is called The Perils of Global Legalism. Talk for a minute, Eric, about the justifications that are typically given by states that choose to violate international law, because both liberals and conservatives will advocate it at times, but they tend to have different reasons.
Well, usually states don't actually say that they're violating international law, even if everybody understands that that's what's happening. So instead, they'll just give a policy justification for what they're doing. Let me give you an example. In 1999, Bill Clinton was the president, the United States launched a military intervention in Serbia. And all of its NATO allies were part of this military intervention. Now, under the international law, you're only allowed to go to war against a country in self-defense or with the unanimous consent, with the consent of the Security Council, which requires the unanimous consent of the five permanent members, which I mentioned before.
And in this case, Russia and China wouldn't sign off on it.
Exactly. And so this law was, you know, quite obviously illegal. I mean, you know, it's hard to call it anything else. Now, the United States and the European countries did give justifications for the war. They didn't say, you know, we're breaking the law, but there's, good reason to do so. What they said is, well, you know, maybe there's a, they put the argument more forcefully than this, but basically they said, well, maybe there's a, you know, an exception, an implicit exception to the UN Charter, which provides that if some kind of humanitarian catastrophe is taking place, then a military intervention can occur despite the absence of Security Council authorization. And in Kosovo, as you remember, there was this severe ethnic cleansing, and various atrocities were being committed by Serbian troops against the Kosovar Albanians. And so now what was going on here is, rather than saying we're violating international law and we don't care, they're saying they're implicitly saying we don't like international law as it currently exists. We think there should be this exception, and we're going to assert this exception in the course of taking these actions which we believe should be necessary. Now, at that, some countries said, you're just violating international law. Other countries, didn't care one way or the other. And that's just how it ended. And then this means in subsequent years, it becomes easier for states to go to war by claiming humanitarian reasons, although it remains ambiguous and probably incorrect to say that there's this humanitarian exception to the UN Charter rules.
So there's no Supreme Court sitting over the international law that exists now. So when a precedent is set by what in our system would seem like a lower court, it just stands.
Yeah, well, there are a bunch of courts, and probably the most important court, which would be closest to a Supreme Court, is called the International Court of Justice, which sits in The Hague. So this was set up at the same time that the UN Charter was set up. And the idea at the time was that the International Court of Justice would be like a Supreme Court, which could do exactly what you're saying. That is, when there's this dispute, you go to the courts and the courts decide what the law is, and then everybody accepts that, at least for a while. But the ICJ the International Court of Justice has never fulfilled that function. It was basically frozen out early in its history, because, the states didn't really want to have this court decide whether their particular actions, going to war or whatever, illegal. And so they increasingly used various maneuvers to ensure that the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, would never get jurisdiction over their disputes.
Eric A. Posner is my guest. He's Kirkland and Ellis Professor of Law at the University of Chicago. His new book is called The Perils of Global Legalism. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Eric A. Posner. He is Kirkland and Ellis Professor of Law at the University of Chicago. His new book is called The Perils of Global Legalism. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Can you talk for a minute, Eric, about why domestic law doesn't seem to help bolster the initiatives and the goals set by international law to the extent that many of its champions believe that it ought to?
Well, yeah, this is a complicated topic. And one issue here is whether American courts should enforce international law in domestic courts. Now, they tend not to, although it's very hard to give a very simple description of what's going on. But very briefly, consider something like the UN Charter. It says you can't go to war without Security Council authorization. The United States did just that when it intervened in Serbia in 1999. Why is it that people can't go to an American domestic court and ask the court to enforce the UN Charter and issue an order to the president not to send troops or, in fact, airplanes into Kosovo? Well, there's a long history dealing with these issues, and just to make it very, very short and simple, the courts just don't want to do that. You know, they're willing to enforce treaties when they've received instructions from the Senate in approving the treaty, or Congress in implementing laws that incorporate the treaty. If they receive those instructions, they'll enforce the treaty. So courts routinely enforce extradition treaties, for example. But there are a lot of treaties that the courts believe the political branches, the president and Congress, does not want them to enforce. Well, and so the courts won't enforce them or try to avoid enforcing them. And this is not only true for the UN Charter, but it's also true for human rights treaties. The reason for this is probably that the judges don't believe they really understand the foreign relations or foreign policy challenges that the president and Congress have to address. I think there's also a lingering fear among the courts that if they try to interfere with the president for something that really matters a lot, like war making, the president might just ignore them, and with the support of the American public, which would greatly erode the power and legitimacy of courts. So courts tend to stay out of foreign relations as much as they can.
And obviously there is no mandate in the permission. One could argue, I suppose, that there's no mandate in the Constitution, and one could argue there's no permission in the Constitution for them to consider international law.
Right, although the opposite argument is made more frequently. The Constitution says that the treaties are the law of the land, and so... Many the courts are supposed to enforce the law of the land, and so the Constitution seems to put treaties on par with ordinary statutes. The courts responded to this very early in the history of this republic, within a few years of ratification of the Constitution, by saying, well, you know, when they drafted the Constitution, they didn't mean all treaties. They said, well, you know, some treaties should be enforced by courts and other treaties should not be enforced by courts. And that depends on what the people who approved of the treaty intended. And, you know, we'll use our judgment to try to figure out what they intended. And so really what was going on is that the founders, they were either careless or optimistic about the role of courts in enforcing international law. And the courts quickly realized as actual cases came before them that they couldn't take literally what the founders had said.
Eric A. Posner is with us. We're talking about his new book, The Perils of Global Legalism. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go first to Nick in Dallas. Hello, Nick.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
All right. I just had a quick comment and maybe a question in here somewhere. I was wondering if the speaker could talk about how the International Court of Justice really is not quite a supreme court for the international community, which is based on its own enabling charter that precedents set. There is no such thing as a precedent set by the court, because all judicial decisions, only have effect for that particular dispute and only between those two countries and are not allowed to be applied. And also, if you could comment on the topic of treaties, the role of reservations and how the International Court of Justice has kind of broken the UN Charter by allowing reservations to treaties regarding genocide and human rights.
Sure, those are complicated questions, and let me provide some very brief comments on them. So the International Court of Justice was created by countries with different legal systems, and in different legal systems precedent, the idea that when a court decides a case, it sets a rule that will bind courts in the future. Precedent has different roles. So in our system, precedent is very important, but in the civil law system that prevails in Europe, it's much weaker. So when these countries got together, they had to figure out, you know, what the rule should be for the International Court of Justice, and they decided to use the European idea, probably because they didn't want the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, to make law in the way that American courts do when they develop the common law, or for that matter, the Constitution. But in practice, these rules probably don't matter very much, because when states have disputes and they're looking for some way to resolve it because, you know, they want to continue to cooperate in good faith, they'll look back at, you know, whatever materials there are, and an International Court of Justice opinion, which is right on point, will probably have some weight in the states' arguments with each other. You know, one state will say, well, you know, the International Court of Justice said that you divide territories in the following way. Shouldn't we use that to resolve our dispute? And the other state might agree or disagree, but it'll play a role. Now, this question about treaties and reservations, these human rights treaties are often very ambitious. You know, they abolish torture and genocide, and they try to protect people's rights to speech and all kinds of things. In some ways, they're similar to the U.S. Constitution Bill of Rights, but in some ways, they're much more aggressive. Because all states don't actually agree with these rules, a practice evolved where they would enter reservations, which essentially meant that if a treaty had, you know, five provisions, they might say, well, we'll comply with provisions 1, 2, and 3, and not provisions 4 and 5. So the question was about whether this is a legitimate practice. The International Court of Justice said that it was under certain conditions, mainly, I think, because they realized that if this practice were not permitted, it would become very difficult for states to enter into treaties in the first place. It's not clear to me that that's a wrong decision. I think it's a pragmatic acknowledgement of how difficult it is for large numbers of states to get together and to enter into meaningful treaties.
Going back, Eric, to this challenge that we have with states that have very heterogeneous systems of government and of law trying to come together and create something that will work for everyone, can you talk for a minute about what we expect of international criminal court justices in terms of setting aside whatever personal understanding they may have of the nature of law in trying to apply it internationally?
Right, so you're referring to the International Criminal Court, which is another international court. It's completely separate from the International Court of Justice, and it's been created quite recently. The treaty behind it was ratified in 1998. The United States is not a party to this treaty, and the idea of the International Criminal Court is to try to prosecute and try people who have committed international crimes, such as genocide and torture and so forth. Now, so the judges, this is a recurrent problem with courts. You can't have, you know, a judge from every country in the world, because then you'd have 190 judges. It just wouldn't work. You just want a small number of judges so that they can cooperate with each other. And then they have terms so that you can replace them. And then these judges bring with them a sense of their own legal system, which might influence how they decide the cases. Now, I'm not sure, you know, how much of a problem this is. What they're supposed to do is enforce international law, and the international criminal law has become pretty developed. But where there are gaps in the law, then they may draw on their own legal systems. This is considered a respectable thing to do in international law. Well, what you want to do is reach some kind of compromises. So when these judges are deliberating with each other, they should draw from their legal systems elements that are common to all of the legal systems and try to avoid using elements which are more particular to a particular country.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Adam in Dallas. Hi, Adam.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, in the case of our previous administration's use of, say, waterboarding techniques and other, arguably torturous techniques to gain information from enemy combatants. Obama mentioned that the CIA officials who were conducting these wouldn't necessarily be prosecuted, but the lawyers at the top who officiated it would. And just kind of bringing that back to, say, the Nuremberg trials, where it didn't fly to say that I was just following orders. What would the implications of having a different internal standard as to your external standard mean? And I'll take this off the line.
Thanks for your call.
Sure. Well, so I think it's pretty clear that the Bush administration engaged in torture, which is a violation of international law. There's a treaty called the Convention Against Torture, which makes that pretty clear. And so, you know, one point just to make is, okay, the U.S. violated international law. Did it hurt its reputation? Did some other state have a remedy against the United States? It may have hurt its reputation. It's a little unclear. People are certainly upset about the torture. Whether they're upset about the illegality is a separate issue. But there's no, as is often the case in international law, no other country or third party can, you know, go to the United States and try to punish it in some way for violating international law. Now, the question was really about individuals. And international law generally binds states, but there's a piece of international law called international criminal law, which binds individuals. And as the caller mentioned, you know, that essentially emerged from the Nuremberg trials after World War II, where the Allies tried Nazis for committing various crimes against humanity. So the Obama administration, you know, the United States does have an obligation under international law to prosecute the individuals who are responsible for violations of international law. This is a kind of a general obligation. And the Obama administration seems to be saying, well, you know, we're not going to, at least originally it said, well, we're not, they didn't say this explicitly, of course, but essentially they said, well, we're not going to comply with that rule either. So the Bush administration violated international law by torturing. The Obama administration continues to violate international law by refusing to prosecute the people who are responsible for the torture. Now, in recent months, its position has softened, although I don't think the caller got it quite right. I think the current position is that CIA agents who were just following orders are not going to be prosecuted, although just following orders is not supposed to be a defense if you engage in something that's patently illegal. But I don't think the Obama administration wants to prosecute those people. I think the only people they really want to prosecute are CIA agents who not only violated international law, but also violated whatever restrictions the Bush administration put on them. So under the Bush administration restrictions, you know, you weren't supposed to kill people and that sort of thing, but some people were killed. That's murder. That went beyond whatever it is that agents were directed to do. So it might make sense to prosecute somebody for doing that. Incidentally, that would, you know, help bring the U.S. in compliance with international law, but that's a pretty marginal thing to do. The people who are responsible for the policies, not the lawyers, but, you know, Bush himself and other top-level Bush administration officials, it seems pretty clear that they're not going to be prosecuted, although if the United States was really interested today in complying with international law, those would be the people that it would go after, much more so than the CIA agents or the lawyers.
Given the lack of punitive power in the international courts, do you think that it even figured into the calculus made by the Bush administration in deciding whether or not to apply these torture techniques to detainees?
I think the members of the Bush administration were afraid. We're actually actually afraid of prosecution domestically, but probably not prosecution internationally. But there are reports from administration insiders that people actually were thinking about this and were worried about this, and for good reason. You know, once the Bush administration is over and it's replaced by another administration, if that new administration wants to, you know, it can certainly launch investigations and prosecute. It may be difficult to convict somebody. I suspect it would be, but even, you know, an investigation and prosecution would be very costly for the people involved. Now, you know, there's the International Criminal Court. Technically, you know, it doesn't have jurisdiction over Americans, except when Americans commit international crime against people from countries which have consented to that court. And so already its jurisdiction is somewhat limited. It also only applies after 2002 under its own treaty. And the International Criminal Court is not supposed to get involved if the domestic authorities are at least engaging in a good faith effort. So, you know, of at least investigating the alleged crime. So, you know, I'm sure they thought about this to some extent, but the chances of some kind of international prosecution were pretty remote. And then, of course, you can always avoid that by just not going to whatever countries that you know, that are party to the ICC.
My guest is Eric A. Posner. He is Kirkland and Ellis Professor of Law at the University of Chicago. His new book is called The Perils of Global Legalism. We'll take more of your calls after the break. You can get to us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372. If you'd prefer to send email, the address is think@kera.org. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Eric A. Posner, Kirkland and Ellis Professor of Law at the University of Chicago. His new book is called The Perils of Global Legalism. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Our next caller is Larry from Dallas. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Good afternoon, Professor.
Hello.
I would like to know your opinion of states like Spain, Britain, Belgium, to name just three, who claim extraterritorial jurisdiction over war crimes committed anywhere on the planet. This seems to be a problem, especially with Israel vis-a-vis the Arab states. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. That's a good question. This has been a big controversy in recent years, although I think this whole issue is going away. So just to provide a little bit of background, there's so under international law, states are supposed to prosecute international crimes such as torture and war crimes. And although this is somewhat more controversial, many states have interpreted this obligation to mean that they should prosecute anybody who's committed any of these crimes anywhere in the world, even if there's no real connection to their own territory. Traditionally, states, you know, you will usually only go after people on their own territory, whether citizens or foreigners who commit crimes. But this idea is, for example, if somebody commits genocide in Rwanda, but he ends up in the United States or Belgium, he could be prosecuted for genocide, even though there are no American or Belgian victims. The person himself is Rwandan, not American or Belgian, and there were otherwise no contacts with this country. Now, this has created a lot of tension because it's the nature of international relations. States disagree very much over what sorts of behavior should be punished and what should not, even though they've nominally agreed that there are a series of international crimes. But, you know, it's one thing to say that something's a crime, and it's another thing to say that, you know, some other country with some other set of legal procedures and, you know, maybe no, not even a jury system and no understanding of our interests, to say that they ought to be able to prosecute that person for committing a crime. So, you know, Roman Polanski, for example, you know, the director has been picked up in Switzerland because he allegedly committed a crime in California, statutory rape, many years ago. People in France are unhappy about this. People in Poland, not necessarily because they think that there shouldn't be a crime against a statutory rape, but because they don't like the idea of Americans prosecuting him, and maybe they don't trust the judicial system in California. So Spain has been the most aggressive country in going after people who violated international crimes under a universal jurisdiction statute. Famously, they tried to extradite Pinochet from Britain, where Pinochet was the former dictator of Chile. He was in Britain for medical treatment. And the Spaniards tried to extradite him and try him for crimes he had committed as international crimes he had committed as dictator in Chile. And this was very controversial. Spain has also tried to go after various Americans in connection with the war on terror, Israelis in connection with conflict with Palestinians, and others. And these countries don't like it one bit. Belgium, as the caller mentioned, also had one such statute. And a complaint was filed against, I think it was Donald Rumsfeld or maybe Norman Schwarzkopf, the general during the first Gulf War, arguing that they had committed international crimes. And the United States essentially, you know, told Belgium to stop doing this if they wanted a NATO headquarters on their territory, and Belgium duly modified their law. Now, recently, the Obama administration has complained to Spain about its attempts to use its universal jurisdiction statute against American officials in connection with the conflict with Al-Qaeda and those policies. And Spain is also backing off, and it appears that they're going to modify their universal jurisdiction statute as well. So, you know, what are the general lessons here? States can agree to all kinds of things. They can agree that certain types of actions are wrong and are international crimes and should be punished. But when it comes down to the nitty-gritty of figuring out how exactly these people should be punished, it turns out that states have a lot of disagreements. And at that point, this cooperation can break down, and nothing is really done to enforce the law that they believe is desirable.
Eric A. Posner is my guest. The new book is called The Perils of Global Legalism. We'll go back on the phone now to Ayo in Denton. Hi, Ayo.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah. My question is, if international law is nothing but a collection of social norms that are not legally binding, is it morally right to hold any state or any actor morally responsible for their action? Thank you.
Right. Well, international law, you know, is legally binding by definition. When I referred to it as social norms, I just meant that as an analogy. It's a weaker type of law than you see domestically, but it's still law. But your question is still a good one. If somebody violates international law, is it morally proper to hold them responsible? Well, you know, I think it's just like domestic law. It depends on what the person did. So during the civil rights era, people violated domestic law, you know, laws against trespass and so forth, in order to make a point that Jim Crow laws were unjust. They were held legally responsible, but I think morally, you know, most people nowadays think that they acted properly. Nonetheless, domestically, we tend to give deference to the law. We tend to think, at least presumptively, that someone who's violated the law has behaved morally badly. And the reason is that, you know, we all are more or less involved in creating this law, and our institutions seem to be reasonably legitimate. It's harder to say that at the international level. If you go back to the Kosovo example, was it really wrong for the United States and the NATO other NATO countries to intervene in Serbia in order to prevent a humanitarian catastrophe? Well, it was illegal, but it may well have been the morally proper thing to do. And international law is, in this sense, because of its weakness and the difficulty of creating it. It seems to me that before condemning someone morally for violating international law or a government, one has to think very carefully about what it is that this action has accomplished and what it is that the law is doing as well.
So, Eric, how can we apply the kind of skepticism that you've presented here in terms of the scope and the effectiveness of international law in order to strengthen it in the places where most sort of agreeing parties would say that it is effective or has potential to be effective?
The problem is just that it's very difficult for countries to build the type of institutions, the type of legal institutions that are necessary to make law effective. So domestically, we have an unbelievably complicated set and important set of legal institutions that are there to enforce the law and to make the law in the first place. And there's nothing like that at the international level. So we just have to ratchet down our ambitions about solving international problems through international law. I think that's really the only lesson of my skepticism, if it's correct. It's just that what countries should do is look around for problems that can be solved with relatively unambitious types of actions, and things like world peace forever or the elimination of nuclear weapons, you just have to give up on them. There's just certain things that cannot be done, that it's not realistic to expect to be done, however desirable they are.
Ultimately, you say legalism is not strong enough to address ongoing disagreements that haven't been solved by politics. Do you think the existence of what at least appears from the outside to be a robust system of international law, before you sort of look more closely at it, has allowed political actors and diplomats to feel like they are somewhat off the hook in terms of trying to find resolutions to these problems?
I think that political actors, I think that's correct in the following sense, that sometimes when they cannot solve a problem, they create a legal institution or they enter a treaty with the full understanding that it's not going to solve the problem either. So during the civil war in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, when the West looked very weak, it couldn't stop this horrible ethnic strife among Serbs and Bosnians and so forth and Croats, what they did is they created an international court that would prosecute and try international crimes that took place in those areas. And the international court ultimately did prosecute and try some people, but it didn't really contribute to the resolution of the civil war. That required a tremendous amount of political action, including military intervention, which was risky and dangerous, providing aid, which was expensive, sending troops and people and diplomats and all kinds of resources to those countries to just hammer out these problems, figure out, what could be done to get the people to stop fighting. So ultimately, a political resolution was reached. The legal, approach probably did very, very little. And you see this in other areas. I think lots of the human rights treaties, these treaties have been ratified by horrible dictatorships, authoritarian countries, places where human rights abuses are very severe. After they enter into those treaties, the human rights abuses continue just as they had before. But the treaties, at least temporarily, seem to take some pressure off both those countries and the Western countries, which tried to get these countries to enter into the treaties in the first place. So I think, to some extent, people might be fooled a little bit by legal activity, and maybe diplomats and politicians might use that as cover when they're not able to effect a satisfactory political resolution.
Let's take one final call from Wosu in Grand Prairie. Hi, Wosu.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah. My question is, there have been complaints from other countries about reforming the United Nations, because they see that these five permanent members have veto powers, and it's really not helping for effective and efficient running of the organization. So is there any hope that there will be reform? Because recently Mama Gaddafi mentioned about it, but there are other countries that are saying, hey, let's reform United Nations.
Yeah, there are very good reasons to want to reform the United Nations. I'm not sure there's much hope that it'll be reformed. So I agree. You know, it's completely unfair that these five countries have veto power and therefore disproportionate influence over what the United Nations does. I mean, France and Britain, at the time that the United Nations was created, could, you know, be thought of as empires, you know, vast, important countries. But they're clearly not as important today as Japan or India, which do not have permanent seats on the United Nations. And other countries have pretty legitimate claims to be on the United Nations, such as Brazil, because of their size or regional importance. But the problem is that the countries, all of these countries have enemies, you know, or rivals who don't want them to have more power. So China and Japan don't have a tremendously good relationship. And so when people say, well, surely Japan should be on the Security Council, should have a permanency in the Security Council, China says, no way, you know, we don't want that. And when people say, you know, when people say that Germany should have a seat on the, because it's the biggest, most important state in Europe, other European countries say, no, not Germany. That would give them too much influence. So we only have the Security Council that we have because of a unique moment in history when the, you know, most of the world was destroyed by World War II, and countries were so terrified of a recurrence of the war that they were willing to give some extra power, to submit to some extra power being given to a handful of the most important countries and most powerful countries in the world. And at the time, of course, the United States and even the Soviet Union had enormous prestige because of their defeat of the Nazis, who were universally abhorred. But now that we're in more normal times, it's very difficult to imagine how the Security Council could be reformed in a way that actually satisfies enough countries in the world for that to happen, which means that it's paralyzed and less effective than it would be if representation were fairer.
We've only got about 20 seconds left, but I wonder if you can talk about why the concept of global legalism is so appealing to legal scholars that, in fact, many seem to have not noticed the limitations of international law.
Legal scholars are deeply invested in legalism in general. That is, this idea that law in general and judges in particular are the source of solutions to the problems. And this idea has a great deal of prestige thanks to the civil rights movement, in which the Supreme Court played a very important role. So I'm not sure they're ignorant so much as just they continue to be hopeful that law can play a role at the international level, which has been as good and effective as it has at the national level.
The new book by Eric Posner is called The Perils of Global Legalism. Eric, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.